Innovation happens when we change our mindset, when we see opportunities in everything we do on a daily basis, right? We live in a world where I see the perfect mix between science, technology, and nature, colliding with innovation as the catalyst.
Our next guest is embracing innovation to show the ultimate impact through her twin ventures of a sustainable beauty brand and one that bridges the pharmaceutical industry and Africa. Find out how next. I'm Ethan Devitt, and welcome to the 50 Faces Focus podcast. I'm joined today by Shalom Lloyd, who after over 20 years in the pharmaceutical industry, has gone on to found two businesses. She's the founder of Naturally Tribal Skincare, a beauty line based on traditional remedies, including shea butter, which she developed initially to cure her son's eczema. She's also the co-founder and chief strategy officer of EMQT, described as the bridge between the pharmaceutical industry and Africa, which facilitates clinical trials for pharmaceutical companies in Africa. She's been a keynote speaker on the topic of innovation and was a fellow of the Startup Leadership Program in London until 2020. Welcome, Shalom. Thank you for joining me today.
Ethan, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, let's start by talking about your background, because this really is a fascinating one. Where were you born and how did you come to study pharmacy in Russia at the age of 16?
I was born in Nigeria. So I'm proudly British Nigerian. I was born in Nigeria and did my primary and secondary education back in Nigeria. And my family, my father had gotten a scholarship actually to study here in the UK through the Commonwealth. And my brothers, I've got four brothers who are here in the UK. And I think I was kept closer to home, being the only daughter and all that. But I was a bit of a nerd growing up. And my sciences were all that I knew. I'm one of those annoying people who kind of believes that nothing is impossible. So for me, it was really my sciences were all I knew. I got into university in Nigeria, actually, at the age of 15 to study industrial microbiology. But there was an opportunity to either go to Brighton to study pharmacy here in the UK or a scholarship to go to the former Soviet Union in the 80s. And I chose that one. I suppose I was running away. Maybe, I don't know. But it was incredible to, at the age of 16, find myself on a plane to the former Soviet Union, USSR as it was at the time. And yeah, I think my life actually began on that flight.
Well, I think we talked about, I actually also spent time in Russia, not at the age of 16, a little bit later, but maybe around the same time you were there. I can imagine that was quite a culture shock that you experienced there. And what was it like and what kind of life lessons did that instill in you?
Oh my goodness. Yes, it was indeed a culture shock because you go to, I studied in a country where I arrived without knowing a single word of Russian or knowing anyone, but it was an adventure. And I was lucky to be raised in a family where it was always full of adventure. People who are old enough to remember having pen pals, we used to have pen pals in Germany and we used to go and visit them and spend months and months there. So I was used to kind of getting outside my comfort zone, but being in Russia was very, very different. Being a Black woman in Russia was absolutely crazy. But I returned to the UK with a BSc and MSc in pharmacy, in addition to a language. And there were many challenges being a woman of color in Russia. However, my experience in the former Soviet Union not only nurtured the scientist in me, but gave me confidence, determination, tenacity, the will to succeed, and the ability to adapt. And the understanding, most important, that my success or my failure was down to me and only me.
That's an amazing story. I'm still quite shocked at you entering, being able to enter university at the age of 15, quite a prodigious talent, even very early on. This kicked off a love for the pharmaceutical industry in you, and you spent over 20 years there. Tell us what it is you love about the pharmaceutical industry.
Gosh, when I came back to the UK from Russia, I started my career in the pharmaceutical industry, an industry I have loved and still love for over 25 years now. I'm building a career in pharmaceutical drug development, enabled me to work from the ground up into leadership roles where I led teams locally, globally, across six countries, managed budgets, led innovation projects and strategic focus areas. It's been my life, really, and the attraction really is having a hand in making miracle medicines available to people who need it. It's really that simple for me.
And can you tell us about your, well, this was your career within the pharmaceutical industry before you moved to your entrepreneurial endeavors?
Yeah, I've always had that entrepreneurial side of me, that entrepreneurial spirit, really, even when I was back in Russia. But when I got into the industry, it would have been easy for me to say, okay, go and sort of take my exams and go and work in either a pharmacy within a hospital or a community pharmacist. But I wanted to do something more. I love interacting with people. So I stumbled across the pharma industry from the sales angle. Actually, I was a sales rep when I was a young girl. It was fantastic. You had a company car, a mobile phone, a laptop, amazing. And it was really trying to get products and drugs on formularies in hospitals. And then I stumbled across something called a clinical research associate. And these were people who were actually working at different sites and running clinical trials on behalf of different companies. And found it so fascinating. And that's how really I got into the drug development side of things, in business development and in clinical research aspect as well, clinical operations. And that has been a passion for me since, you know, watching. It has so many layers to it. And STEM is an area that's really fascinating for me. I worked in procurement for years and years in the pharma industry, which was amazing, in business development. So it was really putting people together, different services together, and actually running local and global teams was amazing. Basel, San Francisco, Nutley, New Jersey, here in the UK. I found that it was something I loved, so it wasn't a chore. So it was no surprise that I kind of moved up the ladder, that career chain, and absolutely found it very, very rewarding. Very rewarding.
Clearly now I can see where the seeds were sown for your amazing sales ability with your entrepreneurial ventures, which we're going to talk about now. There are two of them. So let's start with Naturally Tribal. Can you talk about the genesis of this idea and how you brought it to life?
Yes, of course. I mean, this is my baby. This has been a passion because it was something that was so unplanned. In 2014, after four cycles of IVF, I gave birth to my twins, Amara and Joshua. And Joshua, who's a beautiful boy, was born with severe eczema. He was scratched and he bled. And I spent months combining lotions, creams, emollients, you name it, teas, to stop his scratch till you bleed dilemma, really. In the end, I tapped into my African roots. I kind of thought to myself, what did we do as children? Why have I got great skin? I've got great skin because I was slathered with things like shea butter that are really ancient, been around for thousands of years. And that was something I knew. And because this ingredient is, I'm obsessed with it. It's an emollient, occlusive, and a humectant all in one of the few ingredients to do that. And it became the base. I started to look for essential oils to infuse in this thing that had anti-inflammatory properties, things that would reduce the redness, and complete Eureka formula, stumbled across it. And 3 days later, Joshua's skin cleared. And that was the genesis and the birth of Naturally Tribal Skincare. It was born from personal experience and experimenting.
And then take us from there to experiment in your kitchen, which happened to work, to developing a commercial venture.
That's really an interesting one because it kind of took different turns. So I knew when I was going through this with Joshua, I realized that it wasn't just me. When you go online, focus groups, so many parents, 900 million people on this planet suffer from some condition. Our NHS, love them, spend over 700 million on skin conditions per annum. So it's a huge debilitating area that is not necessarily overlooked, but is not given the attention I believe it deserves because it affects mental health when things manifest on your skin, but it's what people see first, you know, so it can have that impact on people. So when I was actually mixing this thing in the kitchen, I ran out of shea butter, which was my base. And I was looking for a source of shea butter and tapped back into my Nigerian origins. Nigeria is the largest producer of shea butter. So took time off work. I was still working full time at this point. Went back to Nigeria to find a source where I could buy shea butter from to produce here in the UK. I stumbled across this amazing place called the Kingdom of Esan. Oh my goodness, you go there and these women have been making shea for generations. It has been their heritage, their livelihood. Actually, 16 million African rural women rely on the shea industry as a source of income. Yeah, so Esan loved these women, fell in love with them, looked them in the eye and said, somehow I'm going to put you on the map. I don't know how I'm going to do that. Came back home, remortgaged my home, released equity, went back to build a factory in Esan. And fast forward 3 years later, we have a factory now on 16 acres of land that is really talking about empowering women. It's trade, not aid. It is employing women. And we produce this shea butter in the factory, bring it into the UK, manufacture, formulate, test and package here in the UK and make it available to people who want to manage their skin conditions naturally. So the business has really evolved to different sides.
And I love it because it's creating so much impact, not only on the customers, but also clearly on these women whose lives you're transforming through offering them this outlet for their products. So really wonderful circular story there of circularity.
That's right.
Tell us about the business now. So you've been selling online, and I understand you have some plans in store to take this further.
Yes, absolutely. We've been selling online, our e-commerce platform. In 2020, we became Department of International Trade Export Champions. We're also DIT Export Champions for 2021. I love the UK Department of International. These guys helped me to map out where's my market, tapping into the chambers of commerce, actually to understand, well, who's going to buy this thing? What do I do? What certification do I need? What testing do I need? I've been working in the pharma industry, but this was a different area. Beauty was completely new to me. It was a novel area for me. So actually starting from ground zero, sending emails to about 200 manufacturers and getting a reply from only one to say, oh, I can't make, you know, I can only get one person that can make 500 samples for you, as opposed to you need a minimum order of 5,000, 10,000. So went through all of that, but it was really not giving up, knowing the impact that this had on Joshua and wanting to make it available to as many people as possible. So we do sell online. We've got independent retailers. Actually, our first independent retailer company called Nature's Corner in Newbury actually went back to Essan with us, took a trip back to Essan with us to see this traceability journey, to trace our journey. So for me, it's really about involving people in the journey, knowing where your ingredient comes from, that transparency, authenticity. So yeah, we're actually getting that message out there through social media, through our e-commerce platform and through our various stockists.
And just going back to the funding issue, you mentioned remortgaging your house. Did you look to external funding at that stage or have you since?
I actually focused on the proof of concept stage where you're looking at your savings or friends and family and trying to bootstrap this thing, you know, because for me, I'm a strong believer in before you actually go for funding or pitch to investors, you have to prove the concept. And I believe I did because I had to release funding, my own funds, or my husband and I had to do this to kind of bootstrap and get to the level where we felt comfortable that this could be a good investment for us and for whoever wants to invest in this thing. And then we also went down the road, pitched to a company called First Enterprise, guys who I love, they were a lifeline. It was like being on Dragons, then pitched to them, got the funding. It was a loan that we're repaying to actually start to scale up. Looked at various government grants as well. I have continued to consider external investment from VCs, etc. And that's something I'm still kind of mulling over and trying to get my company to the point where, yes, they'll come looking for me as opposed to me looking for them.
We'll talk a little bit more about the kind of landscape for funding a little bit later. So let's move now to talk about your other passion, EMQT, which is also rooted in your pharmaceutical training. What factors led you to launch that?
Everything I do in my life, it's all about impact. Has been a personal journey, really, has been about impact and purpose. And, you know, we throw this word innovation about everywhere. Innovation happens when we change our mindset, when we see opportunities in everything we do on a daily basis, right? We live in a world where I see the perfect mix between science, technology, and nature, colliding with innovation as the catalyst. My father, who passed away and was buried last year, had cancer. And I've worked in the pharmaceutical industry for nearly 25 years. And I truly believe that perhaps if we had a trial that was ongoing in his area, it could have helped somehow. You'd never know. But I've seen the miracle of medicines and what it does through clinical trials. And that was what led to emerging market quality trials. In fact, it was what my passion for this was from that. Again, purpose, impact, a personal journey. Patients of African descent make up about 17% of the world's population, over a billion. But Black people are generally underrepresented in the clinical trials globally, less than 3%. So I'll give you an example. Currently, 95% of cancer patients in sub-Saharan Africa are diagnosed way too late. These are a population of people that offer, you know, drug-naive patients across multiple therapeutic areas. And let's put Africa into context. I think they said, I'm trying to get the data now, between 2013 and 2020 last year, emerging market economies were forecasted to grow 3 times faster than developed countries. The population in Africa is immense. It adds about 3.5 million more people per month into the world. So Africa is huge. It's a huge opportunity. But you have people there who are dying, people who don't have access to medicines. So why can't we utilize healthcare experts and technology innovation to provide access to patients and high-quality data that the pharmaceutical industry wants, but also provide these patients with medicine? So that's where EMQT is going. It's really the bridge between the pharma industry and Africa.
And where is it currently operating and what are your plans?
Wow, EMQT is a UK-based company based here in Milton Keynes. And we have been proudly running projects in various African countries, Congo, Gabon, Tanzania, Nigeria as well. And training and education, capability and capacity building is at the core of everything that we do. Evaluation of centers of excellence, making sure that people are trained, ICH GCP standards. And some of these facilities are incredible because you have medics, researchers, doctors in diaspora who are going back to their home countries who were trained in the Western world. So the capability is there, the expertise is there, the patients are there. There's just a few tweaks we need to make to actually attract pharmaceutical companies to run clinical trials in Africa and make these medicines available to patients.
That's extraordinary, the work that you're doing. But what also really surprised me was the level of underrepresentation in those stats that you gave at the beginning. I mean, another area of obviously underrepresentation is in the area of founders, entrepreneurs, and venture capitalists. There's a phrase we heard before in this podcast which suggests that access to capital is the last frontier of the civil rights movement. You've spoken a little bit about your experience as a founder. Do you have any thoughts on the current levels of access to capital and funding for diverse founders?
Yeah, I mean, there was a report and I was very fortunate to be able to input in this report or have some sort of input into it. It was done by the British Business Bank. I think it was last year. There's a report called Alone Together. And in that report, it was a very, very depressing report, actually, because it talked about things like education, resourcefulness, work ethic and driver, all natural entrepreneurial skills that Black entrepreneurs possess. But still, the barriers that we face are still huge. In this day and age, it was so baffling for me. We are educated in some cases more than most. We are resourceful. We have a good work ethic. So why? And sometimes I think it's culture, confidence, and community that's, you know, the reason for that. One data I keep throwing about there is if you think about as a Black woman, I think about as a woman in general, forget being a Black woman, $250 billion could be added to the UK economy if women started and scaled up their business at the same rate as men. Now, when it comes to Black women, 28%, I think, of the Black entrepreneurs, and they're 50% of the Black working population. When you look at the cultural demands on me as a Black woman, balancing running the business and cultural expectation, etc., there is a pull and a block. There's a pull at home, which is sometimes cultural, raising the family, caring roles, etc. There is a block or boundary or perceived block or boundary that being accepted as a Black woman in business, in the business world, during the scale-up phase where I am right now, if we ask, typically we don't get. So why bother? So it creates this limiting belief that my voice will not be heard in those financial institutions during this phase that I'm going through. The entrepreneurial gene is there. Women in general, in this case, Black women for me, make fantastic entrepreneurs. My success to date in business has been because I got so used to breaking boundaries and barriers to the point where I stopped seeing them. I moved so much outside my comfort zone that I'm comfortable being there. But I had to go through that transition, build my confidence, build my network, and be comfortable in asking. We're usually not very comfortable in asking, particularly financially. You know, there's an issue putting forward financial packages and opening and hiring. There's so many issues out there, but it's about being confident that when we ask, we'll get, which is typically not our experience to date. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And I think you make a very interesting point about limiting beliefs because they can sometimes be our worst enemy. And they can be inside ourselves, internalized limiting beliefs. Do you still face them and how do you overcome them?
I do face them still. Absolutely. I'm not going to sit here and say that, oh, you know, I don't see the glass ceiling, that I don't face the challenges. Every single day you face the challenges. Whether it's somebody judging you just by seeing you, somebody who's just heard your voice, but when they see you face to face, like, oh, okay, I didn't realize that you were a Black woman. So it really does, I still face those things today. But for me, it's about knowing that I have a product or service that is much needed, that solves a problem, that works, that will break those. Last year was a phenomenal year in terms of it started to open up people's eyes to what the BAME community, which is an acronym that I hate, Black people face, really. Social capital is a huge one. I mean, social capital, I keep saying, if you culturally limit yourself to the community where you feel safe in, your network becomes limited. If your social network is limited, there will be no diverse thinking to draw on. So people I meet every day become part of my social capital, my social network. So for me, that is something that we need to tap into a bit more. But I want people to see me as a Black woman, young Black girls to see me and say, if she can do it, of course you can. And it's about going into different avenues, different places, and wedging the door open to say, I'm here. I represent you. I'm wedging the door open for you to come through. So I don't focus necessarily on the barriers. I just go for the solution. And if I knock on one door, they say no, I just keep knocking.
I know you don't take no for an answer. I love what you said about wedging the door open, because you mentioned also that some of the work you do on boards is really to do that in a very kind of an organized way, to really be a role model.
Absolutely. I am so proud to be on the board of SEMLAP. I'm proud to be on an executive director on the board of the Chamber of Commerce here. These are great roles that I take very seriously, that I'm really, really proud of. And again, the pride stems from the fact that when, you know, a young woman sees me and sees, okay, this, she's done it, so can I. And again, it's wedging that door open to say, yep, I've done it. I don't know any better or worse than anybody. I don't consider myself better than anybody else. If I can do it, of course you can.
And just getting for 1 minute, going back to the question of access to capital, do you think if there was more diversity in the venture capital space, or maybe more incubators, or more kind of substitutes maybe for that friends and family round, that that would have an impact?
I think it would have an impact, but let's not underestimate that the fact if I walk into these places to go and pitch for funding and nobody sitting across the table from me looks like me, that's that limiting belief again. I'm thinking they're going to make a judgment. Even if they're not, we've gone through it for so long that you actually have that at the back of your mind most of the time. So it will help. But I think actually having diversity within the organizations who provide funding would be also a good way to go.
Yeah, that's why on this series, we're going to be speaking to a lot of both diverse founders as well as venture capital providers, because I think that's the essential piece of the puzzle that we need to still fix.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So just let's go back to your personal story now. You mentioned breaking through barriers and facing challenges. Were there any setbacks or challenges along the course of your career that you've learned lessons from?
Oh, gosh, yes. You know, for me, it's really, like I said to you before, I'm one of these annoying people that I just don't take no for an answer. And I think it's really built from that foundation when I talked earlier about being in Russia and building this thick skin. When you go through so much, there'll always be obstacles, there'll always be barriers. But I was fortunately one of these people who sees opportunities in everything I do. I was just a girl, good at her sciences, no concrete plans. But I know that science and technology, nature, whatever it is I got into, were going to get me somewhere. When you sprinkle a bit of innovation and a bit of risk taking as well, and putting yourself outside your comfort zone, it does get you somewhere. I'm not going to again sit here and say it was easy, but everything that I've been through, I have this thing in my mind, well, it can't be worse than that. Just go for it.
And were there any key people who influenced you along the way, whether from your family background or along the course of your career?
Oh, God, I've been influenced by so many people along my career, and people who didn't actually realize they were impacting my journey. You know, my brothers in terms of, you know, pushing me, my father, certainly. Today, my husband is my biggest champion and my biggest critic. And what drives me, which is my biggest role as a mother, for my 5 children to look at me and say, my goodness, she did good. She's made an impact in this world. I'm influenced and I look up to the self-made people. the unsung heroes when you look at their stories every day of people who have made something from nothing, just through sheer hard work and tenacity and courage. For me, it's courage, integrity, and passion. And if people tick those three things, I look up to them.
Well, you've given us a lot of words of wisdom here. When you look back at some of these influences and along your journey, is there any creed or motto that you live by or any words of wisdom that have really sat with you?
Oh, I have three that I throw out there all the time. The first one is St. Francis of Assisi says, start by doing what is necessary and then do what is possible. Before you know it, you've conquered the impossible. Start by doing what's necessary and then do what's possible. And before you know it, you've conquered the impossible. I say this to myself all the time. I try to practice what I preach. And the second really is, it is better to be prepared and not have an opportunity than to have an opportunity and not be prepared. I'm always prepared. I'm not really sure what for half the time, but I just prepare. And the third thing is, there will always be obstacles and barriers as we go through our life journey. However, I do believe strongly that failure is an option. Failure is the first step to success. Multiple failures are multiple steps towards success. Name me one idol, one mentor, someone that everyone admires and looks, that has not failed multiple times to get to where they are. We fear failure so much, but I see that as a step to success.
Well, those are wonderful words to live by. So this is clearly being a very exciting year for you in Naturally Tribal. What's on the horizon now? What does the future hold?
Oh gosh, even the future is really, really bright. Coming out of lockdown and COVID-19 and everything that we've been through, it's been challenging. It's been really, really tough. But I can proudly say that when I look back and think, what should I do differently? I've built this company, Naturally Tribal, on three pillars: on efficacy, products that work naturally, planet hugging, ingredients and products that hug our planet, and ethical sourcing, tracing it back to Essan. I normally describe my journey as from kitchen to kingdom, from kitchen to the kingdom of Essan. But I can now describe my journey from Essan to Harrods. So we'll be launching in Harrods Beauty, H Beauty, in Milton Keynes, in our hometown, end of April. Now that is the sort of biggest thing that's happened for Naturally Tribal. For me, that ticks the box of, it's ethical, it's sustainable, it's luxury, it's high-end, it's affordable luxury. So I am really excited. I am really thrilled. I can't stop smiling. But, you know, the journey we've been through, going from the kingdom of Essan to one of the most prestigious stores in the world, is massive for me.
Well, I can't think of a better definition of impact than that, from Essan to Harrods. So very best of luck with that.
Thank you so much.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice. And all views are personal and should not be attributed to the organizations and affiliations of the host or any guest.